I make peace. And so we now call our brother Frank Abel forward to lead us in the words of exhortation. Brother Frank, please.
Well, good morning, brothers and sisters and young people. This morning in this slot of the exhortation, we're actually commencing our first address as well as combining it with the thoughts of exhortation. This whole topic of peace is full of exhortation. It is just from the beginning to the end. I started this study about 3 years ago. I had never talked on it. I've had a sort of a year of hiatus from studying and doing anything intense for a while, but got back into it again. And I must say I don't know if I've got halfway. It could very well be that as you study these things and you come to places where something else opens up and there's another vista you never looked at before. And as you go down that one, another vista opens up. And that's Bible study. But that is one of the most rewarding aspects of Bible study, is that what you thought the subject was, you learned that you knew so little about it, and that it can continue to perform for you. One of the things that I thought of mentioning this morning was just a little event that happened last week. And from time to time, I'd like to take a little diversion from my study, and I was looking at a short video on a man who was trying to film the life of a cheetah. And he said one of the real challenges was ever to get close enough to a cheetah to do any study. He didn't want to spend his time in a zoo, so he went out in the wild to do this study. And he said when he did find out where the cheetahs lived, it took him 6 months riding around in a vehicle to get close enough to the cheetah that it didn't mind him being there. And then in the second 6 months, he actually got out of the cheetah and walked around with the animal, and the animal actually befriended him. And then he lost sight of it for maybe a month or so and found it again, this time with cubs. And this animal and he had bonded so much together that she didn't mind him being with the cubs. And it was an interesting thing because I thought, you know, it takes you that long to get to know something in the Word of God quite often. You go to it to study something, and you just got to spend a lot of time. And it may be just little bits of time, but you've got to spend the time. That's where I found that little video and what I had done in this study of peace connected. So from time to time, you may hear me mentioning that analogy, because I felt that what we have to do to discover the God of peace is to look for him. Now, I'm not looking at a series of passages, although there are a series of passages just with the phrase God of peace, and another set, the peace of God, and there's some beautiful aspects to it. But I thought, how would you discover the God of peace if you were looking for him? Now, we wouldn't go out into the bush to find the God of peace. You will know this passage if you just want to follow with me with a few of these Bible passages this morning. I think it's very important to know the context of and the teaching of this verse 11 of 1 Corinthians 10. We hear this very, very often. It's a subject that comes up from time to time with many brethren speaking on it, where it says, "Now all these things happen unto them for examples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come." Now what I'd like to concentrate just for a second or two is this idea that it was written. So we might have thought they were examples, but if they hadn't been written, we'd have no place to look for the God of peace. We can't find the God of peace in our community by just looking around and looking at how people are affected by God. We can't find them in the bush. We can't find them in the world out there. The only way we can find the God of peace is by looking at what is written. And that takes time. And that's the way God wants us to learn, a little bit every day, if possible. And over 2 or 3 years, it's just amazing how you accumulate so much information. And then, of course, it's got to be grouped together. It's got to be pieced together so it makes sense, first of all, to yourself, and then to other people who may be listening. So there are a number of passages which speak about peace, and there's a number of passages that mention the word peace, and they're not necessarily easy to discover, but as you will know, when you do the Bible reading, sometimes without seeing the word peace, there's a thought there that is peaceful. Now, the prime word I think of when I think of peace is harmony. And so when you're trying to interpret what I'm saying, you might get a real clue when you think of that idea. I think of harmony, of things working together, of hearing various notes that actually blend together in harmony. People doing things together in harmony. And many of the exhortations of the Bible actually come back to us to reflect that idea of the harmony. So we see out in all the nature that we look at, the things that God has created, we see a harmony, which is very hard to explain without a creator. If you look at the balance of life with the big animals and the small animals and how they're all related together, how would you ever get that without someone creating it in place day one? And the more we could discover about little things, even in the forest around here, we could probably be able to see a harmony, things that work together. So we start in Isaiah chapter 45. And I want to take you through some scriptures. I think we can discover the God of peace. First of all, we would find passages which are like this one in Isaiah chapter 45, verse 5 to verse 7. God says through the prophet Isaiah, I am Yahweh, there is none else. There is no God beside me. I girded thee, though thou hast not known me, that they may know from the rising of the sun and from the west that there is none beside me. I am Yahweh. There is none else. I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, Yahweh, do all these things. Now, if you were trying to discover some of the characteristics and the attributes of the God of peace, you'd see a verse like that. That's pretty instructive. But what does it ever mean that God says, I make peace? That's a different word than create in that verse. I make peace. I make harmony, if you like, but don't limit it to harmony. There are other aspects of peace that we will talk about. I, Yahweh, do all these things. And as we alluded to a little bit in just the introductory last evening, we're not looking for a God of peace separate from a God of fire, a God of water, a God of the storms, a God of fertility, a God of all the things that people have thought of as separate gods who may be warring together so that they can get their agenda up front and do the things they wanted to do. That's not the picture we get, as you know, from the scriptures. God doesn't know any rival. I am Yahweh. There is none else. There isn't any other God. So if he's a God of peace, he's also the God of creation. And if he's the God of the creation, he's also the God of everything that we can think of that requires God to explain it or God to carry it out. One God. and we lovingly call him Yahweh. Now, I want you to turn to Ezra. You couldn't do any study really on Haggai, Zechariah, Nehemiah without reference to Ezra. It provides some vital information. So this wouldn't be something that you would necessarily go to right away, but you can see that if you have a study laid out so that you're going to spend a year or 2 years on it or 3 years or whatever it takes, you just accumulate passages and then you come back sometime later on to see the connectivity of these, the harmony that's there in the whole study. So in Ezra chapter 3 at verse 12, and I'm going to have to assume some knowledge of you on this because we don't have the time to go into the background of, you know, the people getting carried away in the captivity and then coming back after 70 years and trying to build a temple and getting the foundations settled and then getting into trouble, because here it is in verse 12. Many of the priests and Levites and chief of the fathers who were ancient men that had seen the first house, when the foundation of this house was laid before their eyes, wept with a loud voice. And many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people couldn't discern the noise of the shout of joy from the noise of the weeping of the people. For the people shouted with a loud shout, and the noise was heard afar off. You wonder why the old man and the old men, they must have been carrying on quite aloud with a loud noise to vie for who could be heard with the young people who were shouting for joy. Why would they weep? And if they were in captivity for 70 years, they must have been pretty old men. But they could remember the temple that was destroyed. They could remember the glory of that temple. They can remember being in that temple. They can remember all the things that it stood for in the age in which it represented, which was not that age any further. And couldn't imagine how a little temple like that could ever have anything that would be like that. The young people had never seen the temple. They'd been away in captivity for 70 years. They'd heard about it, but they'd never seen it. So to have anything like a temple was quite good enough for them. But it represented a division. It represented strife. And strife is not peace. And peace is not, or the lack of peace, rather, is not harmony. That's always a worrisome sign anytime we have anything that speaks of the lack of harmony. One of the things that we're really concerned about, older men are really concerned about right now, is the disparity between the older, the oldest of the community, and the younger, the youngest of the community. It's set apart so drastic that people can't imagine there was ever a time, at least the young people, that you actually had your bread delivered by a couple horses and a wagon. The man came up to your door with a bread basket and you chose your bread. You didn't go to store. He delivered it to you at your doorstep. That's fiction reading for many people. Never ever imagined it. But it doesn't mean it's better or it's necessarily worse than what people do today. They just do it differently. But it's so different, the lifestyles in which people were brought up today, that it becomes worrisome. And it's very easy to get that kind of a division in the meeting when you have the older people thinking one way and younger people thinking another way. I like the analogy of a relay race. Because if we think of a relay race with old men and young men, with old sisters and young sisters, we see the scriptures. They have to work together. And one of the things we would want to be doing as older men is passing a baton to a younger man. We've run our leg. Our leg is over. We want to give it to someone who can run the next one. And they will in turn pass it to someone who will run the next one. That's the spirit of an ecclesia that's healthy. When you see this kind of thing, this weeping, and shouting for joy, you know that difficulty lies ahead. And it was just a matter of a little time when in verses 23 and 24, we read, "Now when the copy of King Artaxerxes' letter was read before Rehum and Shimshai the scribe and their companions, they went up in haste unto Jerusalem to the Jews and made them cease by force and power. Then ceased the work of the house of God which is at Jerusalem. And so it ceased under the second year of the reign of Darius, the king of Persia." But it didn't need to cease. In the New Testament of the age of the apostles, when they were commanded not to teach in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ by the authorities of the land, the work didn't cease. Though the work continued on because these people didn't have these divisions and didn't have this problem. We've got to be very careful when we see those kinds of things creeping up on us. So they made them cease. Do you think the people that were working on the temple really felt good about that? I mean, as we mentioned yesterday, we'll have to mention this many times, there's a peace in terms of thinking about how the world is at peace. It's not at peace. We know that. But there's another piece about what is going on in your head, living in your own life with all the things that are going on. Are you really at peace? Can you read the Bible and stay at peace? Like, because if that's not the context, we haven't got the right context for peace. You could be peaceful and just don't allow anybody or anything to interfere with your thought process. Well, when you read the scriptures, very often that's when we can't be at peace in our mind. And we're provoked to do something. So here were people that I think weren't very happy with themselves. They knew they should have been out there working on it, but now they had some justification for stopping. And if you go to Haggai chapter 1, at verse 2, you will see the reasoning of the people. How did they justify stopping the work? How did they deal with what was not peaceful in their minds? So we read in verse 2 of Haggai 1, "Thus speaketh Yahweh of hosts, saying, This people say, the time is not come, the time that Yahweh's house should be built." So they had justified not doing things, which is just so typical of us, isn't it? That when we have something in our mind that's not resting very well with us, like we feel uncomfortable about it, we just shut it out, or we find some justification for allowing it. And the justification was, well, maybe we are just looking at the wrong captivity period. Like there was several periods of time when there was a captivity, so instead of taking the first one, let's take the second one, which means the 70-year period is not really ended yet, so we don't have to worry about building this temple. That's just so typical of wrong human reasoning. I mean, if they'd only thought about it, God had stirred up Cyrus the Persian, a very remarkable event, to allow them to come back at all. So certainly God thought it was over. And others that would have thought about this with the work of Daniel, that the time was over. So the prophet goes on, verse 3. "Then came the word of Yahweh by Haggai the prophet, saying, Is it time for you, O you, to dwell in your sealed houses? And this house lie waste? Do you really feel comfortable going and working on your own house? And you're not just working, making the house so it you can live in it. You're paneling it. You're taking money and you're converting it to, you know, painting it and to redecorating it. Well, you can see out there that he didn't really get much more than just the foundation laid out and the work stopped. Brothers and sisters, this you can see how it's full of exhortation. And surely if you've done a study in Haggai and Zechariah and Ezra and Nehemiah, you would have encountered these things. It's just one of the richest areas of the scripture for exhortation on life in general. Every generation would have been built up with a study of these this time in history and these particular writings. No, it wasn't proper for them to dwell in seal houses in God's house lying waste and desolate. I think that's a timeless exhortation. Every one of us will from time to time, like it's not, you can make that decision in your early 20s and it serves you the rest of your life. No, because things happen in your 40s, say, and now it's a new situation. You have a better house, or you've moved into a house, your first house. And now you have to face this. Are you going to work on your house at the expense of working on God's house? I don't think, well, we're human, we ever get out of having to deal with that issue. Should we be working on God's work, or should we be working on things which maybe we could justify as needed around our own homes? They're wonderful times to consider this. But then God, with the prophet Haggai, reminds them of something. And that's in verse 9. And I'm leaving out things because of just the time involved. He says, you looked for much when you went out to sow, and lo, it came to little. And when you brought it home, I did blow upon it. Why, saith Yahweh of hosts? Because of mine house there is waste, and you run every man unto his own house. Therefore, the heaven over you is stayed from dew, and the earth is stayed from her fruit. There now, you see, we're starting to see, if you like, the fingerprints, the track, the work of the God of peace. He's not happy with what's going on. And because he's not happy with what's going on, he's going to work towards the ultimate goal that he has with all of us, that there will be a time of peace, just as our brother reminded us this morning, Brother Stephen, in his work on the time of the kingdom age when God's agenda will be fulfilled. God will never be frustrated. It will be fulfilled. It's whether we want to be there and be part of the fulfilling of it. So God says to them, did you ever think about that? That you sowed and all these things happened unto you so that it amounted to God saying, I blew upon it. And what you thought you had, you didn't have. That's what we would call today inflation. We don't have quite enough money to go around because the cost of everything keeps on going up, but the amount of money coming in remains about the same, or maybe even less. So we're going under. We don't have enough money to pay the bills. And God's saying, didn't you think about it? Didn't you think of who has control of those things? Well, that's the God that we worship. So if we go into verse 5 of Haggai chapter 1, I think that's the beautiful thought that comes before, in this particular part of it. God says, consider your ways. Now, sometimes we have little time to consider our ways. Like we really are moving so fast that we just really don't have time, because considering your ways is a bit timeless. Like, how long do you give to considering your ways? How long do you give to really analyzing what's going on and what you might do about it? And for the older people here, you probably do that in the middle of the night because you can't sleep. And you wake up and you think it over and you think it over. And sometimes you get up in the morning, you feel like you've been thinking all night, like you never really had much sleep or not restful sleep. So young people, just think of what's coming if you haven't got to that already. So he says in verse 6, you have sown much, you bring in little, you eat, you don't have enough, you drink, you're not filled with drink, you clothe you, but none is warm, and he that earneth wages to put it into a bag of holes. I mean, it's wonderful language, isn't it? How you could describe what happens sometimes when we don't have enough money to pay the bills, so to speak. Now, do you think God was speaking in past tense all the time? This is a little aspect of the study which I found very interesting. And I don't want to go into the details, but just to make you aware of it, that God tells us when these prophecies came. For instance, Haggai chapter 1, verse 1 is the first month relative to the king. And in verse 15, it was the sixth month. Then in Zechariah chapter 1, verse 1, so it was the eighth month. So we can put these prophecies together. And God's speaking about this idea of considering your ways through all of that time. So it wasn't just that one day God said this and the next day there, you know, everything was different. It eventually got to that. But it would seem that this happened over a number of months of time. Like, if you haven't seen this, you better start looking at your life again because it's continuing. You think you have enough? You look in your pockets and I must have had a hole in my pocket. It's not there. That's inflation. That's the way it works. So they would have had time to consider their ways. Even if they didn't really take time to do it, it would ultimately get to them. The utter frustration associated with that, where we really get into a period of anxiety over how do we deal with what's going on. You see, you start to learn about the God of peace. If God makes peace, then there needs to be confusion to make peace. If we all had peace all the time, then how would God make peace? It's made peace by the fact that God can take those confusing times, those times of anxiety in our life, and he can produce out of that the good that was once a very evil scene. That's the God of peace. And when you start to see these things, you then get a scent for what you're looking for. It's like a person who was looking for an animal and he saw a mark in the ground, and when he had analyzed it, that's the mark of a cougar or a mark of a cheetah or a mark of a bear or whatever, because you could recognize the paw print. Well, we recognize, whether you call it footprints, fingerprints of God, quite often, brethren, use that expression. You see the way God dealt with Saddam Hussein, you know, the leader of Iraq back 20, 30 years ago. That man was going to build Babylon again. And God had said firmly, Babylon will not be built again. So Bible students, seeing this coming on, seeing Saddam Hussein with all the things he was doing, right on the site where Nebuchadnezzar had his temple, building bricks with the new Nebuchadnezzar, pictures on big billboards around Iraq showing a picture of him and Nebuchadnezzar working together. He was going to do before the whole world what God said will not be done. You knew that that wouldn't work out if you believed the Bible. And it didn't work out. And history alludes to how that man came down and all of his work just fell again back into ruins. You see, that's the sign of our God at work. That's the one we're looking for to see. And that's what I think Christadelphians really get, I think, fed on. That you can see in the news something that illustrates to you God is at work. And he's the one that's creating peace. And he's creating the situation that requires peace. If you go to Zechariah chapter 8 and you look at verse 9, you can see these things, God speaking of them through these prophecies which are coming over periods of time, so that now it would seem that people were somewhat able to look back on it. He says in verse 9 of Zechariah 8, "Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, let your hands be strong. Ye that hear in these days these words by the mouth of the prophets, which were in the day that the foundation of the house of Yahweh of hosts was laid, that the temple might be built. Before these days there was no hire for man, nor any hire for beast, neither was there any peace to him that went out or came in because of the affliction. For I set all men, every one against his neighbor." Well, that's a little fact we don't see anywhere else, that really there was a lot of commotion in the ecclesia because nobody was at peace. Everybody was facing the same hardship. I wonder if they really ever thought of that. Maybe there was something wrong in their life. You really have to take some time, don't you, when things aren't going very well in your life, you know, there's something wrong in your job, or you just keep on getting into one problem after another, you can't seem to figure out why it's happening. The ecclesia seems to be getting one problem after another, and you can't figure out. You really do need to take some time and to consider your ways. Everyone needs to do that. Because he said in that verse 10, neither was there any peace. God had taken peace away from them. He was the God that creates evil. He creates evil so that people might learn from their ways that they've got to conform. And God is the master at taking people out of an evil situation and bringing it into a good situation. So all things work together for good to them that love the Lord. Nobody else can do that. God's a master at it. Now look at some of the things he says they should do. Haggai chapter 1, verse 7. Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, consider your ways. Go up to the mountain and bring wood and build the house, and I will take pleasure in it, and I will be glorified, saith Yahweh. Now it's important to see some of these things as principles well beyond the time of Haggai and Zechariah and the people building this temple, so that they're timeless exhortations. They come and support our work just as well as they did theirs. If God states it, God tells us what to do, we do it. He didn't tell them to go back to there and necessarily start on the old foundation and start building. You know, I don't know who had the plan or how many skilled people there would be, but most of the people could do something, at least at the level of bringing wood. That's the most fundamental thing. You've got to get the building materials on site. So go out and get the building materials and bring them to the site. Things start small sometimes to get things moving at a very simple stage where everybody can contribute. There's nothing like having an ecclesia where everybody can find something to do. Maybe we even should create things so that everybody can work together to do them. And see that the outcome is not just to influence the world, although we would love to have people come and join us in our worship by, you know, being converted and giving glory and honor to God. But to keep the ecclesia healthy and happy, we need to have projects where people can work together. That's one of the spin-offs for me of this study, that I found out what my next study is. And it's with a word that appears in the Greek that tells us how to work together. And it's one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. I've never ever encountered a word in another language that I found so attracted to as that word. But that's for another time. This idea of bringing wood, getting out there and building the house, getting back to the work is what's needed. But the work of God is what we're really trying to identify. Where is this God of peace? Well, we see, first of all, in a record we haven't looked up this morning, but I did allude to it, is that if we go to Isaiah, we can see God calling Cyrus, king of Persia, to make a proclamation that the people can come back. And he says to them, I want it written. Now, it's only in our readings that we find out why it had to be written. Because these people were going to need to deal with the fact that the authorities said they had to stop building. And they had to stop building because they had the authority of the king of Persia to tell them to stop building. So when they're going to start again, you might know that the adversaries are going to go right back to the king of Persia. But God had told Cyrus, in one way or another, we see it in the record, that it was to be a written decree. So the next time there is quite a different outcome. When they sent back to the king of Persia, they found this written work of Cyrus. And instead of being the authorities of the land of Israel, or in Jerusalem in particular, now stopping it with force and power, they were told to promote it and to assist it. Very different outcome. God had stirred the king of Persia, and now in Haggai chapter 1, verse 13, It says, then spake Haggai, Yahweh's messenger, in Yahweh's message unto the people, saying, I am with you, saith Yahweh. And Yahweh stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, the son of Jozadak, the high priest, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people. And they came and did work in the house of Yahweh of hosts, their God. That's the work of the God of peace. He was able to get this group of people working together again and establish peace and establish harmony, because it tells us directly that God stirred up the spirit of those people. Now, one of the little spin-offs you get into this is, how does God go about that? Like, how does God stir up the spirit of people? Does he use his spirit very directly and miraculously to stir up the spirit of a person? Or is it something that the person themselves would probably never even know, that somehow or other God has been working with them to stir up their spirit to get to do something they may not have wanted to do, or something that they would have to defend later on, as these people had to? Now, there's a marvelous major Bible principle in Zechariah chapter 1, because Zechariah and Haggai were speaking at about the same time to these people. Both of them were also stirred by God. So God was working, stirring up the hearts of these people. Now have a look at this. In Zechariah chapter 1, in verse 1, it says, in the eighth month, in the second year of Darius, came the word of Yahweh unto Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo the prophet, saying, Yahweh hath been sore displeased with your fathers. Therefore say thou unto them, thus saith Yahweh of hosts, turn unto me, saith Yahweh of hosts, and I will turn unto you, saith Yahweh of hosts. Now, brothers and sisters and young people, that's always the way it is. God has said he will never fail us. He will never forsake us. So if God's favoring us, we never need to be concerned about whether he will discontinue it, except that we may ourselves change. If we've turned unto him, he will turn unto us. Now, it's a principle that sometimes we don't really acknowledge enough. You know, very often if we know of a person in our ecclesia that's sick, or we know someone else that's sick that needs God's help, we will say in prayer that we would request that God would do something for them, that God would help them, God would assist them, God would comfort them, whatever. Do we ever think that maybe what really is needed is to get the person who is sick, just who is sick or whatever, is to turn unto Yahweh so that Yahweh could turn unto them? Not that necessarily because a person's sick have they turned away from God, but if they incline themselves to God, if they recognize the God of peace can help them, that's a major event in getting God to turn to them, to assist them in the project. It's harmony we're trying to achieve with our God. It's working together. It's not just God helping someone that's sick. It's the sick person desiring God to help them. And maybe the prayer is needed there just as much as it is for God to help them, that they haven't really asked God, in some cases maybe even inclined against God, as to think, why would God allow me to have this problem when everybody else seems to be free? Some major principles involved in that. Zechariah chapter 4, another major principle in verse 9, where God says through the prophet, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house. His hands also have finished it. And thou shalt know that Yahweh of hosts has sent me unto you. For who hath despised the day of small things? Well, I think a lot of the older members had. They could only imagine a new temple being something like the old temple in size and magnificence. God didn't see that at all. He just wanted a temple. He just wanted to build something that they could worship him in, and it could be the focus of their religious endeavor at that particular time. There was no need for that controversy. But we had to see what God wants. And I think going up to cut some wood, a very menial task, but something that starts it off, recognize that we incline ourselves to God, He will help us. And then to not despise the day of small things. Brothers and sisters, it may be that that's all that's left to us this side of the coming of the Lord, is to work through small things. But to work and to do things in God's sight that are profitable and agreeable. Now, all this leads us to a couple New Testament passages, just to bring this to a conclusion. If you go to Hebrews chapter 12, you will see this. This is another one of these passages that we use very often. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 5. And here the apostle is talking to the group called the Hebrews, where he says to them, "You have forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children, my son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when you are rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth." We must always understand that there could be a period of inflation in our lives, which is God trying to tell us something. He's working through that method to chasten us, to bring him or bring us back to him so that we can work again in harmony. I think you can't miss these words that are used here. This idea of faint when we're rebuked is important. The idea of faint is sort of relax or to just not have the strength to carry on when we're admonished or we're told a fault. And then in verse 6, "For whom he loves, he chastens and scourgeth." Well, scourging is flogging. And flogging for the Jews would be to take a whip and hit you across the chest and hit you across the shoulders, rather, until you had 39 stripes on you. That's a very powerful word. But it may be that God actually has to do that to get our attention. That's the difficulty with human nature. We're likely to justify wrong behavior, and God working with us, trying to bring us back to him, the God of peace, the God of harmony, will do what he has to do. So that in verse 10, "For they verily for a few days," that's our earthly fathers, "chastened us after their own pleasure, but he for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness." Now that word prophet is a beautiful word. That's the word I was thinking of in this study that brought me to think there's another study to be done. Now, that word prophet is based on two words, which means to bear and to bring together. He for our prophet, to bring together, to restore fellowship, to bring peace and harmony, that we might be partakers of his holiness. And then, of course, you got verse 11 that says, "No chastening for the present seems to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby." And that's where we get this joining from time to time in the study of the actual word peace. So that there's a peaceable fruit that is manifest when God chastens us and brings us back to him, if we respond, if we're looking for it. So in verse 14, it says, "Follow peace with all men and holiness, without which no man can see the Lord, looking diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled." We don't have the time to develop those points, but really the idea of following peace is an interesting thing, because it gets the idea of pursuing. You pursue peace. You don't find peace. You've got to pursue it. You've got to strive for it. You've got to work on it. And then I'd just like to finish off with the Lord, which we are now coming to remember. Because he is the one that is now as it says in Revelation 3, verse 19, as many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Be zealous, therefore, and repent. So the idea of coming back to the Lord and the idea of the Lord working with us to recreate, restore harmony is his work. And his work based on what he said in John 14, verse 27, peace I leave with you. My peace I give unto you. Not as the world giveth, give I unto you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither be it afraid. Like that little verse is one of those verses that you'd want to write and put it down somewhere where you can often think about it. The Lord's intention was to leave peace with them, knowing they were going right into a time of great affliction. But you can have peace in a time of affliction if your way of life, if your thought processes are in harmony with God. It's one of the most enjoyable things is to have peace at a time when other people who have not got that same harmony, haven't restored it or have never made it, do not understand how you could have such calmness and peace in a time of adversity, whether it's in your own life or whether it's in the lives of people around you. So there's a wonderful study involved in this, brothers and sisters. There's many aspects to it. We hope to take a little bit different aspect every day just to try to get a feel for what it means to see the term, the God of peace and the peace of God and all the ramifications in other passages. Thank you.